Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on Radio MD, iHeart, or wherever you download us from. Thank you for doing so. This is 1186B. The B's are always great guests, and we have one for you today. Brian Klass, K-L-A-A-S, the author of Fluke, Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters, is our guest. Our sponsors, Life's First Naturals, the makers of both TruBiotics and Bovine Colostrum. Go to their website, lifesfirstnaturals with an S.com, and find out the data on why they both have really good data on why just about everyone over the age of 50 should be taking both daily. But make your own choice. Go to the website and look at the data at lifesfirstnaturals.com. And of course, our own website, longevityplaybook.com. Go to the longevityplaybook.com website, take the actual age test, and sign up for the free newsletter once or twice a week. The best stories in longevity, the best of my A's. As you know, 1186, the A segments are all the latest medical news of the week and what it means to you. The best of the longevity stories often end up in the newsletter, 250 words summary of what it means to you, and a cartoon to keep you happy to boot as well. Brian Klass is our guest today, and he does write a regular newsletter. I think it is called, if I can, The Garden of 14 Paths, which kind of talks about the paths not taken as well as the paths taken, as I understand it. This book is really interesting. And Brian, when you start and look at the title, it has both things in it that we would support and that we think are wild. So we think, and we know, for example, when you exercise, you change which of your genes are on or not through epigenetic changes, which changes how big your hippocampus is in your memory center, which obviously is a intention why what you do matters. Fluke would say, of course it matters, but then if you run into a tree while skiing, that's a fluke or an unforced error, as we call it. And we think you can avoid unforced errors. You give some very interesting starting stories in the introductory chapter of Flukes. For example, why it was Hiroshima versus Kyoto, and one guy's, I don't know whether it was his wedding trip to Kyoto or whatever, changed that. But one of the most interesting stories in that first chapter isn't that one, but is the escape of the coup. Tell us about the escape of the coup and why that was a fluke and why that matters.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a political scientist, and I think what we try to do is we try to basically ascribe really straightforward reasons for why everything happens, right? And so I was studying this attempt for a coup d'etat in Zambia in southern Africa, where the plan was actually pretty smart. It was to kidnap the army commander at gunpoint and force him to announce the coup on the radio. So they dispatched all these soldiers to do this. And you sort of think this stuff is going to be very neat and tidy and so on. But when I interviewed one of the soldiers, he says, look, I grabbed the army commander's like pant leg in the middle of the night, and he's trying to climb up this compound wall, and I'm grabbing his pant leg, and he's pulling up and I'm pulling down, and he slips through his fingers and gets away. And he goes to alert the government that this coup attempt is underway. And this was really influential in my thinking, because I realized that if he had been a millisecond faster, I think Zambia's government might have collapsed. And yet when we try to think about why things happen in our own lives or why they happen in society, it's always like, you know, if you have these three or four variables, everything will be okay. And I think there's a lot of things in the world and in our own trajectories in life, but for small changes could have radically been different. And I think that's the sort of invisible pivot points that we don't always appreciate in our daily life.
Well, I think of it this way, is I know that if I hadn't had an ex-teacher who hassled me, if you will, or bullied me in today's terms about when I would be good versus not good, I would never have worked as hard and done as well as I did in school. Or if I hadn't been sicker than a dog when I was age six and gotten cured by the miracle of streptomycin back in those days, I maybe would have had a much worse disease, but I would have never decided to go into medicine. So I think there's a lot of evidence that flukes happen. And we see that. I mean, I see that even in some of the very wealthy people today. In other words, you think of John Cook and Steve Jobs hadn't gotten together, maybe Apple would never have been as successful as it was. Or if you will, if Bill Gates hadn't sold Apple's stock, maybe Microsoft and Apple would be one company today instead of two. So there are a lot of flukes in that way. And so I really love the book in that way, but also because you say why everything we do matters. How do you rationalize those two things?
Yeah, so I think this is something that is scientific fact, but is also just so bewildering that we ignore it. So what I mean by this is that everything that we do has ripple effects that are often unforeseen, right? So the stuff that we're talking about when we think about flukes that we can identify, like, you know, I decided to go to graduate school in England and I still live in England, you know, 12 years later. I knew that was going to change my life. I knew it was a pivot point. Whereas I think there's a lot of stuff where, like, I use this term, the snooze button effect, in the book, where it's the idea that, you know, one Tuesday morning you wake up, you're a little tired, you hit the snooze button, you imagine your life rewinds 30 seconds and you don't hit the snooze button. And the question is, does your world unfold in a slightly different way? Does it have a big effect, a small effect? We can never know. Now, the point, though, is that it does change your future in some way, because you will meet different people. You will have different conversations. I mean, the 5-minute delay to your life will affect things. And I think the area where this is most convincing to people, because just so obvious, is that the moment that a child is conceived, for example, if it's a microsecond difference, a different person gets born, right? So on that day, if you stop to have a sip of coffee or you don't, you're creating a different person. And that sort of goes backward the day before that, and so on. So I think, you know, there's a lot of stuff in life where we sort of just assume it just washes out in the end. But I think the beautiful thing about this sort of interconnected viewpoint that I have in the book is that all of our best moments and all of our worst moments are actually inextricably linked. And this is where I tell this story early on in the book about a tragedy in Wisconsin in 1905, where a woman, you know, snaps, probably has postpartum depression, but they wouldn't have called it that in 1905. And she kills her 4 young children and then kills herself. And her husband comes home and finds his whole family dead. This tragedy is linked to me because this is my great-grandfather's first wife, and he remarried to my great-grandmother. And so in a quite literal sense, like, the reason you're listening to my voice now is because of this mass murder in Wisconsin 119 years ago. Now, that means that, you know, bad things sometimes have positive ripple effects. You know, all the joy in my life couldn't exist but for that horrible tragedy. And I think that's a sort of uplifting viewpoint, where a lot of people feel sad in the modern world because they feel interchangeable or they feel unimportant or powerless. And I think one of the things that is scientifically true is that we are constantly reshaping the future in ways big and small. We're just oblivious to it because we can't see the alternative pathway that we might have taken. And I think that's the idea that I find really, really uplifting.
And one of the things you have in some of the chat, and I read about half the books before I get to go, so I haven't read the whole book, but I have read a fair share of it. One of the things you talk about there is how small things can start, or flukes can start wars, which of course scares the hell out of you now in a nuclear age, where you think about the war, the Iranian, or their lack of control of the Houthis and the Hezbollah, who may have powerful weapons that they shoot at American warships and may hit a Russian warship or a Chinese warship and start World War III or a nuclear confrontation. And so we say, holy geez, we hope that fluke doesn't happen, but yet it might.
Yeah, you know, there's several examples from history that are along these lines. I mean, one of the more recent ones is the Arab Spring, which is it's an event that's started by, there's a single man in central Tunisia in late 2010 who was disgruntled, and he was a vegetable vendor, unhappy with his economic prospects. So he lit himself on fire. And this caused multiple governments to collapse and multiple civil wars to happen, right? It was the beginning of the Arab Spring, because it produced mass protests, and then Tunisia's government falls, then Egypt's government falls, then the Syrian civil war starts. I mean, it's just an amazing thing from one person. But the one that's perhaps more profound even is, there's a story that some people know about the start of World War I, where Archduke Franz Ferdinand, his car breaks down right next to this assassin who shoots him. And this is the trigger for the cascading events that lead to World War I. When I researched this, there's an even more astonishing thing where months before this assassination occurred, the Archduke was in England on a hunting trip. And while they were loading the gun, the loader slipped in the snow and the gun went off and the bullet went 3 inches above the Archduke's body. And you can imagine if he had died in an accident, in a hunting accident in England, months before he was assassinated, maybe World War I doesn't happen. And, you know, the trajectory from World War I to the rise of Nazism and the sort of terms of the surrender for the Germans and so on, you can imagine this affects things. I mean, there's so much of 20th century history could have unfolded slightly differently from this thing, with profound consequences for major world wars. And what happens is, when we think about our own lives or when we think about social change, we always stitch together a really neat story, right? It's like A to B, here's what happened, and of course, this is what followed. And when you look at the details of life, I think it's all this stuff that's really messy. You know, we're told to find the signal and ignore the noise. The noise is often where a lot of the calamities of life, sometimes good ones as well, right? Sometimes really positive events, but they're the stuff that really does create unexpected change often comes from the noise and from the flukes.
So you write also about radical uncertainty. I guess I want to know, what is it? And if what we do matters, why is radical uncertainty important?
Yeah, so radical uncertainty, this will be fun explaining this to a doctor, I could imagine. But so radical uncertainty, the way I explain it is, like, you think about Barack Obama trying to decide whether to greenlight the raid to kill Osama bin Laden. And they don't actually know whether he's in the compound or not. They think he might be, but they don't know. There is no evidence that he can marshal, no probabilities, no models or anything, where he can know whether he was there or not. And there's also no way he can forecast whether that raid will succeed or not, or what will happen. There's nothing comparable, right? There's no, you know, you can't say 60%. It's just a confidence guess. So in that moment, he was in a period of radical uncertainty. There was no past information that could help him make that decision. Now, what I think is really important is that there is a difference between questions on radical uncertainty that have to be answered versus questions that don't have to be answered. So, like, trying to forecast, like, the rate of inflation in Malawi in 2035 is radical uncertainty, and it's not necessary. You don't have to do it. But if you have someone who has a really rare disease and you don't really know what's going on, you still have to do something, right? Like, you still have to decide, what are we going to do with this patient? And so that's an area where you might have radical uncertainty. There might be probabilistic forecasts that don't actually fit because it's a truly one in a million case or something like that. But you still have to decide what to do. And so I think when it comes to forecasting and uncertainty, we should split those problems into the must answer, take your best shot, versus the don't need to answer, and let's not pretend we know something we don't know. You know, I think a lot of times we forecast stuff, like in economics, and we're just constantly wrong, and it doesn't have to happen. You don't have to say this is what GDP growth will be in 2030. No one has any idea.
I come back to, in my thought process, is Don Rumsfeld's phrase, the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. And the unknown unknowns are kind of the radical uncertainty.
Exactly.
Meaning we don't even know anything about them. On the other hand, in our lives, we can do a lot of things to avoid and reduce the risk of what we would call unforced errors, and reduce the probability that we're going to live healthier longer. So those are kind of what I would call the why everything we do matters, but we still can't predict if a car is going to hit us because of it going on black ice or a police chase or anything crazy. So there are always radical uncertainties, but we can reduce those to as small a possibility as possible. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. So, and the reason for that in health, by the way, is because human bodies are relatively interchangeable. Not always, right? I mean, but on aggregate, if you do probabilistic forecasts and you say, like, look, Advil is going to work to reduce headaches on average, that's a smart thing to think. the difference in some of the worlds of, you know, social change, or what I talk about in the book of chaos theory, is that this is not true. So like September 11th, for example, if that plane had been on September 10th, it might not have succeeded because there was a massive storm. It was very bad weather. So some of the planes would not have taken off probably, right? And then the terrorist attack may not have succeeded. If it had been September 12th, maybe there's a different group of people on the flight that goes, Flight 93, that gets taken down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. They don't act. Maybe the White House gets destroyed, right? So in those instances where you have chaos theory dynamics, where even changing the date for the same attack could yield profoundly different results, that usually doesn't hold true if you're actually comparing apples to apples in the more closed biological system of a human body. So I think this is where, you know, the questions of probability, they work really, really well when you have something that you think, whether I have Advil or you have Advil, on average it will work to reduce headaches. There are some realms of social change where that is absolutely not true, because, you know, the Bin Laden raid, if it had been 2 weeks later and he'd left, it might have provoked a massive, I mean, possibly even a war with Pakistan, because, you know, they would have failed to apprehend him, and then there would have been violations of sovereign airspace, all this stuff. So the point is that it depends on whether you're comparing apples to apples and whether you can do repeat trials to figure out whether something is actually probabilistic. So I'm not taking issue with the idea of, you know, trying to minimize risk. The debate is, what is risk and what is radical uncertainty? Risk is something you can tame. Radical uncertainty is something you simply can't know.
And that's the key in your book, as I look at it, is the fluke is the radical uncertainty, and the reducing risk is why everything we do matters.
Yeah, and you should. I mean, when it comes to risk, it's like, you know, like sports are a great example of this. Like, sports are a very closed system, so you should optimize. Like, using data in sports works. And it works because you know that it's the same rules, it's the same teams every year. You can predict things, and you can know that if you have, you know, like in baseball, if you have the shift put on, it will probabilistically increase your chances of getting an out. And so, like, these sorts of things are, you know, it's very smart to use data in these forms. But like, a lot of the world is not like a sports game, because there's no rules and we can't predict what the outcome will be in any sort of feasible
way. And the radical uncertainty, I would say, in the football game is whether the referee sees the event, sees the hold or the pull.
Yeah, indeed.
One of my favorite athletes is a guy named Ed White. Do you know who Ed White is?
No, I don't think so.
Ed White was a pulling guard who led Herschel Walker
when
for the Minnesota Vikings. He was all pro for 16 of his 21 years in the league.
Well, I really should have known this. I'm a huge Vikings fan.
He was a Rhodes Scholar. So he went to Berkeley and was a Rhodes Scholar, took a year off between college and pro ball to be a Rhodes Scholar in England, came back and was at the Vikings for, I think it was 14 years at the Vikings. And then he went to the San Diego Chargers and was a pulling guard for Dan Fouts, pulling in a different way. He was able to pull the defensive tackles down without the referee seeing it. That's the value of a really bright guard who could, he ran the 40 in 4.1. So he was incredible in college. So I call him the radical certainty, if you will, because he was able to do it without the referees seeing it most of the time.
That's funny.
So he avoided the radical uncertainty of whether the referees seeing it or not. One of the things I took away from reading the book and reading the chapters on armed conflict is that if you think of flukes starting world wars, there's an awful lot of high chance that a fluke could cause a nuclear war, except for the control of the people who have the nuclear, whatever you call it, code to not do it. Meaning there's a high radical uncertainty that someone will do something that would provoke someone, and the only thing that's going to stop it is having very controlled leaders as leaders.
Well, I'm going to scare you here, because this has already happened very, very closely in the Soviet period, and we only found out about it more recently. But there was a Soviet soldier who saw on his computer screen a massive U.S. launch of incoming ballistic missiles, and the protocol told him to launch. Like, effectively, it was time to, it was like, look, this is the real thing. And what had turned out to have happened was they put in a training piece of software by accident into the computer. And so it was a simulation that everyone thought was real. And this guy defied his superiors, basically, to buy time to check that it was real. But they had said to launch the nuclear weapons. This is during the Cold War. And if this guy was a different person who was more prone to obedience, which is what they were really looking for in the Soviet army, I mean, they would have started World War III and probably killed, you know, millions of Americans. So, I mean, it's quite literally one guy who just said, hold on, this doesn't look right. If the Americans were going to do this, they would have done hundreds of missiles, and I only see 10 coming in. So that little beat of sort of pausing probably averted the end of civilization. So this is the kind of stuff that keeps you up at night. But it is, you know, we have developed systems where when stuff goes wrong, it can go really wrong. And that's where we're a little bit beholden to the risks of these unfortunate flukes that occasionally do crop up.
And the worry I have on AI is that an AI system would have seen that and actually launched the missiles rather than the guy saying there are only 10.
Yeah, we've basically embedded systemic risk through AI in ways that are different and new and bad. And I think AI can solve a huge number of problems very effectively, but like there are real concerns, I think, about handing over the sort of control of society to things that can be accidentally provoked into making very bad decisions.
Much more of this fascinating discussion can be found in Chance, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters, the subtitle to Brian Klass's book, Fluke. The book's name is Fluke, F-L-U-K-E. It's available on Amazon. And Chances, Chaos, and Why Everything We Do Matters. The author is who we've been speaking to, Brian Klass. If you want to talk about his newsletter, which you can get, it's available. You can Google Brian Klass. Or, of course, you can read, you can go to the Garden of 14 Paths. Google that. This has been 1186B. The B's are always great guests like Brian, and the A's, the latest medical news of the week and what it means to you. I also want to thank our sponsors, LifesFirstNaturals.com, LifesFirstNaturals.com, the makers of both Truebiotics, No Fluke There, and Bovine Colostrum. I discovered that by a fluke. When COVID started, I searched for things that stopped upper respiratory infections. And believe it or not, a randomized controlled trial in Italian soccer players taking it showed that it decreased their upper respiratory infections by over 65% and kept them on the field when other teams couldn't be on the field. And other randomized controlled trials showed that it decreased the shortening of the gut when you take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen or even aspirin. That's Bovine Colostrum, 2,000 milligrams a day. You can get both and see the data at LifesFirstNaturals.com. And of course, the Longevity Playbook, where you can take your actual age test, find out your actual age compared to your calendar age, and sign up for the free newsletter, which has one great longevity tip a week with a cartoon that's hopefully related to it that'll keep you happy. One of the things that kept me happy is that you, our 50,000 people or so, have downloaded us this week. Thank you for doing so. Tell your friends about us. Rate us. I hope you'll be back next week, as I will be. And we'll probably have another great guest, but it'll be hard to top Brian Klass. Thank you, Brian. We'll be back next week.